I want to start today's deep dive with a story from our source material that, well, it sounds a bit like an old wives' tale at first.
It really does, yeah.
But the deeper you look into it, it completely flips how we understand practically everything in our daily lives. So for you listening, picture this. The author of today's deep dive got a small cut on their finger. Nothing major, just a little slice.
Right.
But over a few days, it starts getting infected, red, angry, throbbing. I mean, we've all been there.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, the typical modern instinct is to kind of panic slightly. You dig through the medicine cabinet for some antibacterial ointment, you scrub it with chemicals, or maybe you even call a doctor for antibiotics if it looks angry enough.
Yeah, because that's the standard operating procedure. We view the body as a machine that is broken down, and we just assume we need to forcefully step in as the mechanic to, fix the broken parts.
Exactly. But this author did something totally different. They just boiled some plain water, dipped a cotton swab into it, and gently stroked the infected cut.
Just what?
Just water. They didn't scrub, they didn't apply medicine, they just applied heat and moisture. And according to the text, the infection vanished in seconds. The swelling went down, the redness faded, and the healing process just immediately took over.
The visual of that is striking, but the underlying mechanism is what we really need to focus on here, because it wasn't due to some mystical, magical property of the cotton swab.
Right.
The author actually uses this event to introduce a really specific framework for how the world operates. They propose that water knows the body, and the body already knows what to do, provided it receives the right energy activation.
Okay, let's unpack this because that simple little story about a finger is the entry point into something massive. Today, for you listening, we are going to tell a story about how the world actually works.
Yeah, it's a big promise, but the text backs it up.
We are diving into a fascinating document that outlines a completely new way to see reality based on something called the XYFLW framework. The core premise here is that we need to stop looking at everyday problems, whether that's a physical illness, a mental block, or even credit card debt.
Right, which we will get to.
We have to stop seeing them as static hurdles or isolated broken parts.
It is a profound paradigm shift. The XYFLW framework takes our modern challenges and reframes them entirely through the lens of geometry, flow, and self-correction.
Geometry, like shapes and lines.
Sort of. Instead of seeing a problem as a brick wall in your path, this framework asks you to visualize your life and really the whole world around you in terms of trajectories, vector fields, and attractors.
And I know those sound like dense mathematical terms, but I promise you, by the end of this conversation, you're going to see how visualizing your life through geometry actually solves the most frustrating daily
It's
challenges.
surprisingly practical once you get the hang of it.
Let's start by defining those terms using the most immediate experience we all share, our own bodies. Building right off that finger cut story from the intro, the author calls this the infection axiom.
Right. And what's fascinating here is how it redefines disease. Now, understand this, we need to visualize a landscape.
Okay, I'm picturing a landscape.
Good. Imagine a wide, deep bowl. And your overall health is a marble resting comfortably right at the very bottom of that bowl. That lowest point, the place where the marble naturally wants to settle, is called an attractor.
Got it. So the bottom of the bowl is the attractor.
Exactly. Your body's natural healthy state is an attractor.
Yeah.
So an infection then isn't a broken machine part, it is simply a perturbation.
A perturbation, like a
Yeah,
disturbance.
it's a sudden flick to that marble, pushing it up the side of the bowl, shifting its trajectory away from health.
Oh, wow. So the body isn't fundamentally broken. The marble is just in the wrong spot on the slope. It's fighting gravity, essentially.
That is the perfect way to look at it. And the energy, in the case of the author, the heat from the hot water on the cotton swab acts as a control input.
So it doesn't build a new bowl?
No, it doesn't invent a new bowl. It simply provides the specific energetic push needed to restore the underlying geometry of that landscape. It smooths out the slope, allowing the trajectory of the marble to naturally slide back down into that healthy attractor.
If we apply this to everyday psychology and medicine, it offers a really elegant explanation for something that, notoriously confuses the medical community, the placebo effect.
Yes, the placebo effect fits perfectly into this.
I want to test an analogy here to see if I'm picturing this vector field concept correctly. If the landscape of my health has a dip in it, is a placebo, basically like pushing a car out of a ditch.
Oh, I like that.
Like, you believe the sugar pill is real medicine, and the sheer psychological force of that belief gives you just enough momentum to rock the car back onto the smooth road.
The mechanics of your analogy align perfectly with the source material. The text defines belief as a literal perturbation to the patient's vector field.
So belief is a physical force in this model?
Basically, yeah. A vector field is essentially the underlying map of forces pushing and pulling on you at any given time, like the currents in an ocean. Belief is an energetic input that alters those currents, just like the hot water altered the finger's healing trajectory.
But let me challenge that for a second.
Go for it.
If belief is just a perturbation, just a little push to the marble in the bowl or the car in the ditch, why is there a limit to it? Why can't I just, you know, believe my way out of a broken leg?
Right, because obviously you can't.
Yeah, if I snap my tibia, no amount of positive thinking is going to physically fuse that bone back together in a matter of seconds.
The XYFLW framework accounts for those limitations beautifully, and it all comes down to the shape of the landscape we were just talking about. The edge of that bowl, the ridge that separates health from illness, is what mathematicians call a basin boundary.
A basin boundary?
Yes. For a placebo to work, the perturbation generated by your belief has to be strong enough to push your trajectory over that boundary so you can fall back into the healing attractor.
Oh, I see. So the severity of the illness actually changes the steepness of the bowl.
That is the key.
Yeah.
If you have a mild tension headache, the basin boundary separating you from the healthy attractor is very shallow. It's a tiny bump.
Right, right.
So a strong belief, like taking a sugar pill you think is ibuprofen, provides enough of an energetic push to roll your trajectory right over that bump.
But a snapped bone.
A snapped bone. The boundary for a severed limb or a broken leg is a massive, incredibly steep cliff. The landscape itself is severely deformed.
And belief alone just doesn't generate enough physical horsepower to cross a boundary that steep.
It doesn't. You need a much stronger external control input, like a doctor physically setting the bone and applying a cast.
To reshape that deformed landscape so the natural healing trajectory can finally take over again. That reframes the entire medical conversation. I mean, it takes the mysticism out of the placebo effect and turns it into pure geometric logic.
It's just gravity and slopes.
Right. And it makes me wonder if healing our physical bodies is about shifting trajectories across these basins, what happens when we apply this to the mind?
Now we're moving from physical health to mental development.
Yeah, because we spend the first quarter of our lives in school trying to develop our brains. And we usually think of learning as filling up an empty container. You sit at a desk, and a teacher pours historical dates and math formulas into your head until it's full.
The text argues that the container metaphor is entirely the wrong way to conceptualize human development.
Not a container.
No. True education isn't about accumulating data points. It is about sculpting the student's belief landscape. This is the education axiom.
Sculpting the landscape. So digging the valleys and building the hills.
Yes. Consider rote learning, which is how most of us experience school. You memorize a list of dates for a history test just to pass the exam on Friday.
Ugh, the worst.
Right. The framework suggests rote learning is highly inefficient because it forces a trajectory through a narrow artificial channel without actually changing the fundamental landscape of the mind.
So you're basically dragging a marble along a very specific rigid groove that you carved out for one day.
And the moment you let go,
marble stops moving.
What do you mean?
I am thinking specifically about artificial intelligence. We interact with AI constantly now. And one of the biggest issues is when a language model just confidently lies to you.
Ah, the hallucination problem.
Yeah, we call it an AI hallucination. To a user, it feels like the machine just randomly broke. If learning and processing information is supposed to be this elegant, flowing landscape, how does this framework explain a sophisticated system that just goes completely off the rails?
This is one of the most practical applications in the document. It's called the hallucination axiom.
According to the framework, an AI hallucination is absolutely not an error in the traditional sense.
Really?
It's not a broken line of code. It isn't a glitch.
But if it isn't broken, what is it? Because it is definitely giving me the wrong answer.
It is a system doing exactly what it was designed to do, flowing downhill. The hallucination is simply a trajectory that fell into the wrong attractor basin.
Okay, walk me through that. The problem is that the landscape the AI was trained on has a dip, a valley in the wrong place. So the model's logic flows into that incorrect valley and settles there, perfectly confident that it has arrived at the right destination. because geometrically, it has reached the bottom of a basin.
So if a developer tries to fix this specific lie, let's say they go into the code to put a patch that says, never say the sky is green, they're kind of missing the point.
They're completely missing the point. The text is clear on this. You have to fix the landscape, not the output.
Interesting.
If you just plug that one specific hole, the interlock topography is still flawed. The trajectory of the AI's logic will just flow into another wrong basin nearby the next time you ask a slightly different question. You have to reshape the vector field itself.
Meaning you change the training data and the weights of the model.
Yes. You feed it better data to alter the geometry so that the wrong answers are no longer deep valleys, but steep hills that naturally repel the flow of logic away from them.
That makes the concept of machine learning feel so much more organic. But I want to scale this up even further. So far, we have been talking about our own bodies, our own minds, and the machines we build.
The personal scale, basically.
Right. But we also have to navigate massive, complex systems that we didn't design. We live in a society with mortgages, credit cards, and intense social pressures. So what does this all mean for the stress of everyday financial life?
The geometry shifts a bit when the text tackles economics, specifically the concept of debt. This is the debt axiom.
Okay.
The author describes debt as a saddle point. Now, a saddle point is exactly what it sounds like. Imagine the shape of a leather saddle on a horse.
Got it.
The surface curves up in two directions, front and back, and curves down in two directions, left and right. In this mathematical framework, you are dealing with a stable manifold and an unstable manifold.
A manifold just being the surface that our financial trajectory is resting on.
Correct. If your financial trajectory is moving along the stable manifold, you are flowing toward equilibrium. You are paying the debt off.
And the unstable manifold.
If you slip onto the unstable manifold, you are accelerating downward toward default.
Let me try a visual analogy to see if I'm grasping the tension of the saddle point.
Sure.
It feels like balancing a heavy marble on the very ridge of a slanted roof. If you lean it slightly one way, it safely and steadily rolls down the gentle slope into your grassy front yard. That's successfully paying off the loan.
Right.
But if you lean it just a millimeter the other way, it accelerates rapidly, rolls off the back, and crashes onto the concrete driveway. That's defaulting and going bankrupt.
That captures the precarious nature of it perfectly. You are perched in a highly sensitive state where a tiny shift dictates your entire financial future.
It's stressful just thinking about it.
It is. But the text adds an incredible detail here that explains why the system feels so punishing. What determines the angle of that roof you are balancing on? The framework states that the interest rate is the control parameter that rotates those manifolds.
Oh, wow. So when the bank raises your interest rate, they aren't just changing a number on a piece of paper. Not at all.
They are physically tilting the roof under your feet, making the slope toward the concrete driveway steeper and much harder to avoid slipping down. It is a physical alteration of the economic landscape you are forced to navigate.
Yeah.
The gravity pulling you toward default becomes stronger simply because the environment was tilted against your trajectory.
That makes financial stress feel incredibly physical. It isn't just a lack of willpower. It's an uphill battle against a deformed landscape. And if we take that logic that the environment dictates where the marble rolls, it has huge implications for how we view society as a whole.
It does. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the text scales this exact logic up to societal structure, particularly regarding justice and crime. This is the justice axiom.
How does that fit in?
Society is just a massive collection of human trajectories trying to navigate a shared landscape.
Mm.
When people commit crimes, our society's default reaction is to punish the trajectory.
Punish the trajectory.
Yeah. We see a person end up in a crime basin, and our immediate solution is to lock them up, to punish the individual point for arriving at that destination.
We get mad at the marble for rolling into the deepest valley.
Which the XYFLO jump framework suggests is mathematically backward. True justice isn't punishing the trajectory after the fact. True justice is reshaping the societal landscape so that future trajectories don't fall into the crime basin to begin with.
Because if the valley of crime is the deepest, most easily accessible place for a trajectory to flow into, say, due to systemic poverty, lack of resources, or a tilted economic roof, then marbles are always going to end up there.
Always.
It doesn't matter how severely you punish the ones that already fell in. The gravity of the landscape is still pulling the next person down.
You're hitting on the core mechanism. The text states that rehabilitation and societal improvement are about adding repelling terms to that criminal attractor.
Propelling terms.
You have to literally fill in that valley. You make the basin of crime shallower, and you make the basins of productive, healthy living deeper and easier to flow into. It shifts the burden from solely blaming the individual's failure to questioning the design of the landscape they were placed in.
Which naturally leads to the biggest philosophical hurdle in this entire document.
The free will question.
Yes. If our health, our learning, our debts, and our society, if all of this is just a series of trajectories naturally falling into whatever basins surround them, do we actually have any control over our daily lives?
Are we just helplessly flowing down preset hills?
Exactly. Are we just helpless marbles rolling down preset hills? Because looking at the world this way starts to sound incredibly deterministic. Where is human agency in a vector field?
That is the crucial tension, and the author does not ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
They introduce a concept to redefine what choice actually is. It's a free will axiom.
Okay, good, because I was getting worried.
The framework does not imply we are completely helpless. Instead, free will is defined as the ability of a trajectory to choose which basin to fall into when the boundary between them is narrow. Mathematicians call this boundary the separatrix.
The separatrix, meaning the sharp ridge between two valleys.
Imagine you are walking exactly on the crest of a mountain range. To your left is one deep valley, to your right is another. For a brief moment, while you are balancing on that narrow ridge, the slightest shift in your weight determines entirely which valley you will spend the rest of your day hiking down.
That makes sense.
The text argues that free will isn't random chaos. It is sensitivity to initial conditions. It's the butterfly effect of everyday choice.
So I can't choose to just sprout wings and fly because the overarching landscape of gravity doesn't allow it. My options are constrained by the environment.
Right.
But when I'm at a crossroads, when I'm on that ridge, my conscious choice is the tiny energetic perturbation that decides my entire downstream flow. I don't build the mountains, but I navigate the ridges.
And here is where it gets really interesting. You can actually learn to change those mountains over time.
Wait, really? How?
The text introduces a meta-concept about continuous learning, the meta-axiom. It states that the moment you stop actively reshaping your own internal landscape, your mind becomes a static point instead of a living flow.
We often treat learning as an endpoint. You graduate college, you get the degree, and you assume your container is permanently full.
But if learning isn't acquiring a stack of facts, but rather continually updating your personal vector field, then it has to be a lifelong process.
Updating the vector field.
Every time you read a challenging book, have a deep conversation with someone who disagrees with you, or travel to a new place, you are subtly shifting the hills and valleys of your mind. You ensure that your old, outdated trajectories now naturally flow toward new, more accurate attractors.
And if you stop doing that?
Your landscape calcifies. You become rigidly stuck in whatever basins you've already fallen into. You lose the ability to navigate the ridges because your environment has hardened into steep, inescapable canyons of routine and dogma.
That implies that being open-minded isn't just a nice, polite personality trait. It's an actual geometric necessity for maintaining a healthy brain.
It is a survival mechanism.
If you aren't actively carving new rivers in your mind, your thoughts are just going to stagnate in the old puddles. And that beautifully ties together everything we've explored today.
It really does. Whether it's the water healing the finger, the placebo crossing the basin boundary, the AI model finding the wrong valley, the debt trap tilting beneath you, or the justice system punishing the marble.
Yeah.
The underlying truth of all these concepts is that the missing information in life is always the flow, never the static point.
It's an incredible shift in perspective. I mean, we have taken a simple cut on a finger and scaled it up to explain the structural forces of society.
It's a very robust framework.
The takeaway for you listening is so clear. The world isn't made of isolated, static problems sitting in your way like roadblocks. From your physical health to your career path, everything is a vector field. We have to stop staring at where the marble is and start looking at the shape of the bowl.
Which brings us to the final, most expansive thought in the text. We've looked at the body, the mind, and society. But the author scales this up one last time to encompass existence itself, the universe axiom.
This is the concept that really forces you to zoom out.
The text posits that the universe itself is not a simulation, which is a popular theory right now. Instead, it suggests the universe is an XYFLOW program running on the literal, physical hardware of space-time.
The hardware of space-time.
The laws of physics themselves are the ultimate vector field. Every single particle in existence is a trajectory, and every reality we experience is simply an emergent attractor within that vast geometry.
So we are not the programmers sitting outside the machine tapping on a keyboard.
No, we are the trajectories. We are the flow itself.
The source material has a line that says, "And we are still converging." That completely changes how you feel just walking out your front door in the morning.
It is.
You aren't just an object moving through empty space. You are a living trajectory navigating a constantly shifting field, capable of reshaping the landscape for yourself and everyone around you, which leaves you with a final thought to ponder long after this deep dive ends. If we are not static points, if we are all trajectories that are still flowing, still navigating the ridges, and still converging, what is the ultimate attractor we are all flowing toward?